Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to a fresh edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Thank you, Carlos. We've got a cool guy named Santana right here in the studio. I'll introduce to you in just a moment. Our program is underwritten not by corporations, but by listeners like you. And I want to acknowledge the annual sponsorship of Kathy Burwell. There is a powerful new documentary coming to a screen near you about a huge miscarriage of justice multiplied by five. What a lovely, lovely world. And fortunately, this story does have a somewhat happy ending. The film is called The Central Park Five. It is a new documentary from Ken Burns, one of the preeminent documentarians in America today, the guy who has brought you so many great documentaries on PBS. One of my favorites, Ken, is Jazz, and you've got The Dust Bowl, which is screening this fall on PBS. And I saw online that you have projects scheduled out for almost the next 10 years.
Exactly. We try to take the long view of things. But this particular one, The Central Park Five, is produced and written and directed not only by myself, but my daughter Sarah and her husband, my son-in-law David McMahon. And they deserve equal credit for this film.
You got that filmmaking DNA passed down to the next generation.
The apple didn't fall far from the tree in this case. She's a really extraordinary human being and a really extraordinary filmmaker and writer.
Yeah. Well, this is a powerful documentary, and we're joined in the studio, I promised you, a Santana. Raymond Santana has a smile on his face today, but he went through quite an ordeal when he was falsely accused and set up by bad cops, prosecuted by bad prosecutors, and left to rot in jail until the real culprit came forward. Raymond, it's a real pleasure to see you.
Thank you for having us.
What's it feel like to see a movie made about the exploits of your life, particularly when you spent so many years in jail, probably thinking you'd never be here at a film festival in Marin County, California?
Yeah, I mean, you're very true on that. You know, this film has given me opportunity to meet a lot of great people. It has given me opportunity to go a lot of great places. But the film itself, when I watch the film, is very, it stirs up a lot of emotion. You know, it takes me back to that time.
Yeah.
But it also has this arc, you know, where things change and it starts to become very liberated. You know, you start to feel like this all this amount of pressure is finally off of you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you get to finally tell the world that, you know, I told you we were innocent.
Yeah, yeah. And I just want you to know that it touched me, both Ken and Raymond, in a very personal way. I had a brother who was falsely accused as a juvenile, and it ripped our family apart. And Raymond, like you, your dad took this very, very hard.
Yes.
And the episode in my life was, you know, I didn't grow up in Harlem. I came from an upscale neighborhood, an all-white neighborhood in Cincinnati. And my brother was framed because he went out jogging one night, and the cops picked him up and accused him of breaking and entering in a house down the street. And I knew all along that he hadn't done it. And I'd like you to take a moment here to talk about how it feels to be swept up into the system when you know you're innocent And they're lining up all this crap against you that makes it look like you were responsible. You were one of the five people who brutally assaulted this young woman in Central Park. And you were there in Central Park that night. But that's about as close as you came to having any involvement in this crime.
Yes, it becomes very frustrating. You know, I come from a big family and five uncles on my mother's side, and I had three uncles on my father's side, and, you know, grandmother, cousins, and everybody thought we was guilty. And so I lost a lot of that. You know, they all shunned away from me. The only person who was ever in my corner was my dad. So you feel all alone. It becomes very frustrating. You don't know what to do. There is no guidance. Nobody's coming to help you because, you know, due to the media, the impact of the media, a lot of people wrote us off and didn't care what happened to us. So you just felt all alone through this whole process, and you just felt like it was just us five against almost the whole world.
Yeah. Ken Burns, when did you, and first of all, let me say, from here in California, I heard about the case. It was salaciously reported, and it was a young white woman and these people of color, Raymond and four young black teenagers who were accused. And it seemed like a slam dunk case. And the way it was played in the media, I probably swallowed it hook, line, and sinker.
I know, so I did at the time.
Tell me when you first started to suspect.
I heard about it when everyone else heard about it. It was like, what's happened to our cities? This was April 19th, 1989. These boys were accused of wilding. What had happened to our families? What kind of people would do this? It's what everyone felt, and it was accepted in all corners. And it just wasn't true. And there was enough evidence that should have set the police and the prosecutors wondering. There was enough inconsistencies that even the press could have picked up on, but everyone just went along with the luridness of wilding, of wolf pack. It calls to mind the language of Jim Crow. Before you hang somebody, before you lynch somebody, you're using the words Negro beast, black beast, wolf pack. All of these things are reminiscent of something we expected from turn of the 19th to 20th century Jim Crow South. We didn't expect it at the end of the 20th century in progressive New York City, but it was happening because these things are always there, and many of my other films happened. I was vaguely aware that the convictions were vacated, but like everyone else, this got filed away on page
D23. Yeah.
My daughter, when she was at Yale University, had an internship with the law firm that was working on the civil rights case that once the convictions were vacated, and you have to understand, they were out of jail.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd served their full terms for this crime and had, every time they came up to parole, consistently said, I didn't do it. If they'd said we did it and I feel really bad, they might have gotten out of it. But it's a measure of their own personal heroism that they didn't do that. But they're all out. So this vacation of the convictions is sort of, you know, at least a victory, but a bit of a Pyrrhic one. My daughter was aware of this and got so into it that she wrote an undergraduate thesis called Representations of Race in the Central Park Jogger Case. After she graduated, went to work for this law firm, working on other cases, not this one. And then a few years later, quit and just said, you know what, I really want to write a book about this. And as she started handing me the first pages that she was writing, it was fantastically good material. We just knew it was a story. It fit in with all of the other themes that we've tackled over the last several decades. But we've also, it was an opportunity to do things differently. There's no narration in this film. Mm-hmm. There's at times, extraordinarily fast-paced cutting, and then at times a sort of making you sit and experience what these kids went through at the time. There are two 14-year-olds, two 15-year-olds, and a 16-year-old who was, because of a hearing problem, you would say was developmentally challenged a bit and maybe a few years younger than that, who was then treated as an adult all the way through, sent to Rikers Island, where the other four went to the Spofford Juvenile Detention. It was no picnic, but Rikers Island
You're thrown in with the adult professionals.
The worst of the worst.
Yeah.
And so this is one of those cases where at every instance there was an opportunity for someone to say, hey, time out. This doesn't make sense. The cops should have known it in their guts, but they were excited to solve this crime of the century, as Mayor Koch called it. The prosecutors, you can see written on their faces in the archival material that we have, they look like they know deep down that this isn't the right thing, but they're plowing ahead. The actual rapist comes forward after they've served out their full terms.
Yeah.
His DNA is the only DNA that matches any other human being besides the victim to the crime scene. the city reinvestigates and joins with the defense, very unusual, to vacate the convictions, which is granted in a nanosecond by a judge.
Now, let me turn to Raymond, because do you share the same description as Ken? And I'm not trying to start a fight here. But number one, I don't assume that the cops had the best of intentions. Number two, I don't believe that the prosecutors, who knew, for example, that the confessions didn't match, and we'll talk about the phony confessions in a moment, but also that they didn't have a DNA match. And they went forward with this prosecution and rode the wave of negative publicity to become heroes in the crackdown in crime on crime in New York City. So Raymond, what's your characterizations? And by the way, we don't have any language restrictions here. So if you've got a favorite word for the cops or the prosecutors, don't hold back.
Yeah. No, I feel similar as Ken. You know, this was a situation where, you know, they had the chance to do the right thing, and they chose not to. You know, once the DNA evidence came back, all the red flags should have came out and everything should have stopped and said, hold on. The right thing to do was go back and reinvestigate. And instead they said, no, let's just move forward.
There's a lot of really damaging stuff. 2 days before this famous incident, a woman was assaulted, got away. She identified her attacker. It turned out to be Mateus Reyes. And they had his name and they could have gotten him, and somehow that was dropped. Later on, that rape case sort of disappeared. Sexual assault case. It wasn't a rape. And several other crimes Reyes went on to do that summer after the Central Park jogger attack, as the cops were focusing on the boys. Now, there were a lot of boys in the park making mischief, rolling drunks, getting up to no good. And so they figured, and I don't think insincerely, that maybe these guys did it. But the inconsistencies in all of their testimonies, they didn't know. They had to basically put words in these kids. But it was the pressure to solve this crime of the century rather than a vast conspiracy. It was the idea that, yes, we've got it, they tied it up in a bow, but here is the real crime, is that not only did Mateus Reyes not get captured right away on the 17th, so this we wouldn't even been talking, but that after the Central Park jogger case happened, he went on to rape some more and to kill a pregnant woman, and finally was captured by citizens that summer, and one of the detectives involved in his arrest was the detective who had interrogated some of the boys and could have easily walked the DNA marker from one case over because the MO was the same and all this other stuff. It wasn't the MO of a bunch of kids, you know, assuming, you know, that they had done this, but they were not even anywhere near the actual event in the park. So it was one of those things where now as we unfold a very factual story, this is not agitprop.
No, there's not advocacy
at all. In fact, we begged the cops and the ADAs and others involved to speak. They did not. We wanted to show the humanity of all involved. I think it's reflected in their inability to come forward. They hid behind the civil suit, but have not had any problems making snide comments about us in other media forums. So clearly they were just terrified of the dozens of questions that we could ask that they would not have an answer for.
Let me share with you that we're sitting in a little room here about a mile and a half from San Quentin. And I've spent a lot of time there over the last 25 years. I've worked with a group called the Freedom Foundation. And it preceded the Innocence Project in trying to identify those who were innocent of the crimes that they were incarcerated for. And the patterns are so similar. Bad cops who extract or supply phony confessions and use various forms of duress to force somebody to say, okay, I did it. And we have bad eyewitness testimony. The gloss has finally come off of fingerprint evidence.
Yes.
The FBI has admitted that it's not as foolproof as they have tried to pretend for so long. And then we have bad prosecutors who are trying to avoid more bad publicity and just put somebody in jail for a crime. And Ken, as you pointed out, it's really important to note that when you get a public victory that is in its essence a false conviction, there is a criminal who is still out there. And that is one of the more, you know, the violation of Raymond and other civil liberties is
egregious. As let us also say Trisha Miley, who was the rape victim at the time. Let's not forget that tragedy. But there's also a woman and her unborn child who was murdered. And we believe, had the cops been doing their job well, had the prosecutors been saying, wait a second, you're not handing us the right case, that woman would be alive, that baby would be now, however old that baby would be, 23
years old.
Yeah. Now, Raymond, walk us through for a couple of minutes here the events of that night and leading into the way that the confession was extracted from you. Because it was the confession and then the videotaped version of it that each of you had to submit to that was essentially used to convict you, absent the physical evidence that should have been there.
Yeah, well, I can't give you too much detail on the events that night due to civil litigation. And the only thing I can say as far as the confessions are concerned is that, you know, when you look at the facts that pertain to those confessions, is that we were 14 years old, never been in trouble with the law. And then you, on the other side, you have these seasoned detectives who have been on the force over 20-some years. This was the homicide detective squad. This was the elite of the whole precinct. So there was really, and then you add pressure into the equation, and we had no chance. We had no chance that we was going to come out of there without something.
Mm-hmm. This is a circular firing squad. They're saying, Raymond, we know you're a good kid. You didn't do this, but there's another kid that he's never heard of in another room saying that you did do it. And if you just say that you saw this other kid do it, then we'll let you go home. And after 30 hours, people really want to go home. They want to eat. They want to see their parents. They're 14 years old. They're 15 years old. They're 16 years old. They're scared out of their minds. Their parents are there periodically. They're scared out of their mind. They're afraid the cops might kill them. There's all this sort of stuff that is going through their minds. Miranda just doesn't cross their minds. Stopping talking doesn't cross their mind. They're just trying to please. You got some parents say, just tell them what they want to hear, meaning they're saying they believe you didn't do it, but let's just do it. And so the circular firing squad takes place, and they wake up, and all of a sudden they realize, oh, my God, we've implicated all of ourselves. We're now. And these were, of all of the kids in the park that night, the ones that were the most vulnerable. They were from good families, intact families. They hadn't been in trouble with the law. They didn't know how to lawyer up. They didn't know how to shut up. They didn't know all the stuff that the kids who were doing a lot of the other bad stuff, not the rape of Trisha Miley, but the rolling of drunks and the assaults on other stuff, they just knew what to do. And so they ended up not having the same kind of experience that these five kids did, who were totally new to the system and really thought, you know, Raymond particularly thought, I get it. If I just do this, I get it. I go along with them, I get to go home. And so he works on really struggling to make this happen.
But and there's this moment, Raymond, where you have sung the song the way they wanted you to.
That's right.
And then your dad comes into the room, and they repeat your confession to him. And he said, what? Yeah. What? My son admitted to this? And you said you were really torn because you had never lied to your father and didn't know how to do that. But you felt that the only way out, the only exit available was to agree to this concocted story the detectives had fed to you.
That's true.
So talk about that and how you ultimately resolved it.
And what happened was that when that happened, and you know, I was caught in the middle because here I was trying to tell my dad to relax, you know, like everything's taken care of. And then also in that instance, Sheehan is the one who he was when I was reading the statement. And so when my father did try to interject, Sheehan is when that stopped him. And then, you know, he proceeded to belittle my father. You know, listen, you know, you're a hardworking man. We can make it hard for you, too. And so in that process right there, I saw my father coming down to my size. So now there was nothing that either one of us can do.
And I mean, when I watched that depicted in the film, and Ken, you did an excellent job of allowing me, you know, the viewer, to have an emotional response. It wasn't loaded in one direction or the other. But just that human moment of the, you know, the choices before you, and you're 14 or 15?
14 at the time.
I mean, I want our listeners to think about what your wits were like, what your experiences were like at the age of 14. And when you're confronted with some of the toughest cops who are even overdoing it, all right, and forcing you to admit to things that you had no knowledge of, That's got to be a real mind twister.
It is. It is, because at 14, you know, you're young, you're naive. You know, you don't even know how to put on your clothes straight. You know, you still have to be taught all this stuff. You know, I was a young adolescent. I didn't experience much, and then to come across, you know, these seasoned detectives, you know, it was a no brainer. You know, I mean, when I look back at it now, I'm surprised that I even held out as long as I did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we're talking over 30 hours of questioning.
Yeah.
And I'm surprised that I even held out that long.
Now, Raymond, have you ever heard the name Omar Khadr?
No.
He's a Canadian guy who was picked up by our forces in Afghanistan at the age of 15. And just last week, he was transferred from Guantanamo to a prison in Canada.
Yes. Okay. I did hear about that. When he was in Montreal, they had him on the news.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And I just wonder if you have any reaction to the tactics that have been used by our government in the so-called war on terror. The harsh interrogation techniques, as they're euphemized, I call them torture. Mm-hmm. And Mitt Romney says he wants to return them to use. He wants to put them back in the Army Field Manual. And, you know, particularly in the case of Khadr, the real-time events appear to have been spun up. He's accused of killing an American soldier named Speer. And yet there was a crossfire underway at the time. There's legitimate claims that he actually didn't have a gun and was wounded before the events occurred that killed Speer. But the way it happened, he was picked up. He was tortured in Afghanistan. He was taken to Guantanamo, arrived there at the age of 15. And I just wonder if you have any connection or any sense of revulsion at the tactics that our government has been employing in the fight they call against terrorism.
I mean, I think the tactics that the police use on us were like the surface. They were just the very beginning. I mean, if they could waterboard us, I think they would have. You know, with Romney coming in and he wants to implement this type of stuff, there's no telling how far it can go or where it can go or who it can be done to. And that's something that people really need to look at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, if it can happen to me, it can happen to you.
Ken, do you have a comment on Omar Khadr?
No, I mean, I'm aware of it. And one begins to realize that the story that we tell in the Central Park Five raises issues of race. It raises issues of power. Raises issues of politics. It raises issue of government's role in our lives. And it raises a fundamental issue of character, which I think that the film reveals. You suddenly have spent 23 years assuming that these five boys, then men now, were these black beasts, these marauding wolf pack of wilders. And then all of a sudden you meet them and in our film. And they have families, and they have a moral code of ethic. They have character. He can't lie to his dad. He swallows hard at moments where he realizes that he's recalling a lie, as does others in the film. You see etched over them a kind of sense, and then you realize at the heart of this, it doesn't need to have any sort of larger political or racial or power symbolism brought into it. It's really about when you make a mistake, as Jim Dwyer, the reporter, says. When you make a mistake, you own that mistake. If you don't own that mistake, it speaks volumes of your character. Mm-hmm. And I think in the end, that's what this is about. There were people who understandably wanted the crime of the century solved. They thought they had the people. They clearly did not. The evidence shows that they were already doubting that, but they plowed ahead with it. And once, 13 years later, when it was found out, and insignificant human beings went to jail for it, just black and brown kids, mm-hmm. but they don't matter. They're nameless, faceless. Remember who they are. They don't have lives. Suddenly have to have lives again because it turns out this was wrong and the conviction is vacated, they've now spent a decade pushing back again, offering alternative realities because they're stuck in a lie and they can't get out of it. And the only reason and the only thing they know how to do is not say, you know what, we really screwed up here. We are so sorry. They push back and invented which means that Raymond and his four brothers have to live in a limbo. So you have justice denied for 13 years, a tragedy of Shakespearean dimensions because of, as you mentioned, each one of them had a family dynamic that exploded like a hand grenade in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
It just rippled out and rippled out and rippled out. But then you have justice delayed now for nearly a decade, which is, as we know, also justice denied. So one of the things we hope is that the media, which was so silent, so complicit with this, went along with the lurid headlines, went along with the inflammatory, if it bleeds, it leads coverage, now has an opportunity, as this film comes out, to add volume to our film and to say, hey, wait a second, we will not accept this before. Let me just tell you that in the early 60s, there was another case very similar to this, that a black man in interrogation confessed to a murder and was charged. The media in New York said, wait a second, this doesn't make sense. This stinks. And they actually got this guy off and freed, and all of that plowed everything towards Miranda.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead to the Central Park jogger case. What that did was, with the media, just took a bye. Everybody, they accepted whole cloth, all the stories. Nobody did investigative journalism about this, saying, wait a second, this doesn't add up. Just looking at these tapes, it doesn't add up. Just looking at the evidence, there's no DNA. Wait. What did they do? This ended up in essentially plowing towards the reinstatement of the death penalty in New York State. As a result of the outrage, people were prepared to murder, in the name of the state, children.
Mm-hmm. Well, here in California, the governor just signed a bill last week that, under certain circumstances, allows a juvenile convicted of murder without possibility of sentenced to a life top without possibility of parole. A mechanism for a rehearing as an adult, so that they actually do have an opportunity to present an innocence route like habeas corpus, but it does permit the possibility of parole for some of these teens who've been swept up in a kind of hysteria. And in recent years, even as we have a ballot measure this November that may overturn the death penalty in California. And I'm pleased just that the prospect is there, that people's minds are shifting. But television has been the major driver, and it's not just television news, but it's these crime shows that blur the line between reality and entertainment. And then we have Nancy Grace, who piles on for half an hour every night and tries to convict the suspect before the final commercial rolls on her show. And so the mentality is not to investigate, not to honor the assumption of innocence until proven guilty, but simply to rush to judgment and say, I saw a video, so I know the facts of the Trayvon Martin case. I don't need anything more.
The media culture doesn't necessarily have to know the Constitution of the United States. It operates by different laws. And what we're saying is, the good news is that in addition to it, there are a lot of documentaries that have been instrumental in freeing people, that have been instrumental in changing the dynamics of cases, that have been instrumental in helping in the service of justice. And that's a good thing. And so what we realize is that we don't make blanket statements, that we see in our American selves, we see both generosity and greed. We see Puritanism and we see purience. We see a kind of mob mentality and a courage to stand up to a mob. We see justice and we see injustice. And what we still have is at least the flexibility to talk about it. We still have a First Amendment that allows us to talk about it and understand that we still live in a place where words matter. And that while a lot of people are screaming and yelling, and what Nancy Grace does is she sort of blots out the possibility of having a real conversation about what actual the presumption of innocence is, what actually the Constitution is about, what actually is due process, what actually is evidentiary rules. We still have an ability to go click and turn that off. We have the ability to write, to speak, to yell, to use every megaphone we can. And in the case of the Central Park Five, for us to be willing to submit ourselves to the story that wasn't told and to put it in totally fair and non-manipulative, just the facts context, so that you can come to your own sensibilities about this. But then what will you do? What does it say to you? How will you act? what flaws within yourself, what dark shadows that you have, will you then try to overcome? What friction will you, you know, exert against the tendency to just say, well, you know, a lot of blacks do commit a lot of crime. You know, they must have done something that night.
Yeah.
You know, this is what you find.
What you just touched on at the end there is really important, Ken. There are a lot of cops in particular who say, well, I don't know if this guy did this crime, but he's a bad guy.
Yeah.
And we're doing everybody a favor by taking him off the street, even if we have to gin up the evidence, punch up a witness, make something disappear. Raymond, what are your thoughts about the role of the media? And in particular, when you have looked back, especially at the New York Post, in its coverage of your case, do you even recognize yourself?
You know, when it comes to the Post and the Daily News, I don't even read those papers because in the beginning, you know, what happened to us was just so wrong. You know, over 400 articles was written on us within the first 2 weeks of this case. And how do you dissect a 14-year-old kid's life? You know, how do you go back and scrutinize his life? What has he done? He hasn't done anything. You know, and to write all these articles on us and give us these labels, you know, you lose the trust within the media. You know, and like Ken has stated earlier, you know, the best thing that we ask for the media to do is to right a wrong. This time around, make it right. Don't put us, you know, in the back of the newspaper. You know, put us where we belong. Put us in the front.
But there haven't been 400 stories about your exoneration.
Exactly. So now, you know, but it's never too late. It's never too late to make a difference. It's never too late to make a change. And that's what we're asking them to do now. Mm-hmm. You know, recognize that we are innocent. Recognize that we didn't commit this crime. You know, support the movement. Support that what we're trying to do.
Raymond, I've talked to a lot of ex-cons. I've even talked to a couple of guys who have been released from Guantanamo. And one of the things that is remarkable to me is the lack of bitterness. And I know people who've done 30-year stretches who should have been released after 10. And, you know, they walk through that process with a kind of inner strength that I really admire. So how did you find your inner strength in that experience?
You know, I went through a process myself going through this case that, you know, there was times where I thought that it was the end of the world. You know, I thought that this label, the Central Park Five, is going to be with me forever. I was going to go to my grave label as a rapist. And so what happened was I had to embrace that title. I had to say, this is it. This is who I am. You know, when the convictions got vacated, you know, and that boulder was lifted off me, but that title still stood there. You know, it came now with a title of innocent, but the Central Park Five stood there. And because I embraced it, you know, I'm able to walk today with my head high and able to do the things that I do as far as speaking out,
mm-hmm.
you know.
But you don't seem angry. At least you don't present that way to me.
Well, I wasn't an angry kid, you know. I mean, you know, this happened to us, but, you know, we went through our, you know, we went through, you know, like me, I speak about it in the movie, how going through prison, you know, I came back with characteristics I didn't know exist. You know, people had to point that out to me. So that was a change right there. And then once I learned about it, I had to adjust. But I understood, and it all comes with understanding what's going on. You know, when you become older, you start to understand what it is that's, you know, influencing you. You can make a change. But we was good kids. We weren't bitter kids. We weren't criminals.
It's mm-hmm. really true, and it's a remarkable thing that in a situation in which the psychological hangnails of our own lives cause us great anguish and despair, when you think what Antron and Raymond and Yusef and Corey and Kevin went through, and that they've come out on the other side with this magnanimity and this kind of grace about this, it's really inspiring, and it takes mm-hmm. it beyond the politics of it. It takes it beyond the racial dimension. It becomes, you know, ultimate lessons in humanity. And we feel better people for having heard and tried to retell the story that permitted them that humanity. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, we just go, wow, you know,
yeah.
this is pretty impressive stuff. This yeah. is pretty impressive stuff.
Now, some of the life prisoners who I know are the most inspiring people in my circle because they could... I mean, I've been into San Quentin over 100 times, and I like to tell it this way, that I've never been asked to spend the night, okay? But each time, you know, there is a real feeling of stress and anger. And I don't like to submit to the orders of the guards. I've never been strip searched. But just having to empty my pockets and put up with all the bullshit going through the metal detectors and being treated like a prisoner, you know, just for a few hours is something that is hard for me to take. And so to imagine to be there year after year and have to give up my independence, give up the ability to talk back to somebody and say, you know, F you, man, I don't want to do my laundry today. I just have a deep respect for the people who can go through that and come out the other side relatively balanced and without, as I said, a lot of anger and bitterness.
Yeah, we've been blessed. We've been blessed and fortunate that we were able to come out that way. You know, it could have been a whole lot different.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So, Raymond, tell us what you're doing today and what your life is like.
Well, for me, you know, life is still a struggle day by day. You know, because, this chapter still isn't closed. You know, for the city, you know, to come forward and apologize would be a good step in the right direction, but they haven't done that. And so by them not doing that, it's going in the opposite direction. You know, where now they're still saying we're guilty. They're still saying that, you know, they have these theories. Either Reyes went first or we went first. And so that still holds us back from moving forward finally. You know, once we can get past this and we can close this door, then we can finally move forward and live our lives as productive people.
Now, are you a registered sex offender?
No, I'm not. No, uh-huh. I'm not. Not anymore. I uh-huh. used to be. And we had to register as sex offenders. We had to attend sex offender classes, which, you know, as Yusuf and I'm talking in the movie, we got kicked out of those several times.
Because they wouldn't cop to something they hadn't done.
That's right.
Well, and let's talk about that for a moment, because I've seen this come up. I've advocated for life prisoners. And only recently, since Governor Brown took office, has the parole process in California been working properly. 81% of the guys who get a date from the parole panel are released by the governor. Under Schwarzenegger, it was about 18%. Under Gray Davis, it was less than 1%. Under Pete Wilson before him, it was about 4%. And so it was a highly politicized process. And they were all just saying, no more Willie Hortons. I don't care if this loser has to sit in a cell for the rest of his life. My political career is on the line. So we're seeing a dramatic shift. But the way this process does respond to public pressure and not the rule of law is deeply offensive.
I mean, you know, these guys are going to be coming out of prison sooner or later. And you'd rather that they be prepared and ready to be productive than just put them out there and leave them in the street. You know, if a guy goes to jail and he winds up, you know, getting his GED and he winds up getting a college degree and he serves all this time, he deserves a shot. He deserves a shot. But after you give him a shot, you can't just put him on the street and say, all right, there you go. You have to give him some type of proper transition.
Well, yeah, here in California, you get $200.
See? And that doesn't work because within 6 months, what is he going to do if he can't find work? So you still have to help him along. It's like being a kid all over again. You have to teach him how to do certain things. It's the same thing with a prisoner.
We also have this extreme law that was passed by the initiative process that bans a sex offender from living within 1,000 feet of a school or a park. And there are so few places in the state that fit that qualification and also have some form of affordable housing for people, you know, who can't get a decent job and make a good living. And it's just like, you know, throwing them out under the freeway and saying, we don't care. You know, we're sitting here secure in the knowledge that we can change the channel on our TV and get rid of anybody who we deem offensive or low life. So can you get a job? Because you still have to check the box that says you've been to prison, don't you?
Well, no. Well, because my record is cleared now.
Yeah.
So I work now.
Uh-huh.
You know, I work. I do have one felony, which is a nonviolent crime. It's a possession charge.
Uh-huh.
You know, but besides that, you know, I work now. I have a full-time job. And that's only because of the Central Park case, those convictions were vacated.
Uh-huh.
If not, I couldn't obtain employment.
Because
who's going to hire a convicted felon, especially a rapist?
Mm-hmm.
Especially someone who was supposed to be involved in the crime of the century.
Crime of the century.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we hope you have a chance to spread the word about this film, because we need people to see it, and we need people to be outraged, and we need people to talk about it.
And what is the distribution plan? It's screening at the Mill Valley Film Festival as we speak here in early October.
It's been to the Cannes Film Festival. It's been to Telluride and Toronto and Montreal. It's going to London and Vienna and Brisbane. It's going to be the closing night of Docs NYC on November 15th in New York City, and will open theatrically in New York and L.A. on the day after Thanksgiving. That's the 23rd. And in the Bay Area, it will be opening in Berkeley and probably at Landmark, and a yet-to-be-determined probably Landmark in San Francisco on December 14th, and eventually be broadcast on PBS sometime in 2013.
Okay. Well, Ken and Raymond, I just want to tell you, it's a very powerful story that's being told here. And Ken, I'm glad that you used your juice, if I will, to bring this important story to the American people. Because, you know, just in the past week in California, a man was exonerated of a murder charge and released. A man named Thibodeau in Mississippi, who's been, you know, falsely incarcerated for more than 15 years, was cleared for release. I don't have news that he's actually out yet. But the Innocence Project has shown that upwards of 200 people on death row were completely innocent of the crime that they were projected to be killed for. And yet we have so many people captive to this Nancy Grace and entertainment crime syndrome, who just are content to make a snap judgment and write off the lives of human beings.
Well, this is the thing. It doesn't get tied up in a half an hour or an hour. The crimes don't get solved that way. It's a much more complicated process, and we have to rely less on our entertainment sources than on our civic sources for the solution.
Yeah. Ken Burns.
Thank you.
Pleasure to see you. Raymond Santana, I'm really glad to see you alive and free.
Thank you. Thank you, bro. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. If you know somebody's in prison and they're innocent, help them get out.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.